We're going to start with Senate File 1394, Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, Senate File 1394 is an opportunity for the city of Proctor, in my district, to increase their local option sales tax. They currently have a 0.5% local option. This would give them an opportunity to go back out to their voters, and if it's approved, get an additional 0.5%, which would make them the same as Duluth, their neighboring community. The argument oftentimes in Proctor is, you know, they shop in Duluth and they pay 1%, but when people from Duluth come to Proctor, they only have to pay 0.5%. And Proctor does have some needs for some additional revenue. So I have with me the city administrator from the city and former city councilor and active member of the chamber also to speak to the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Please state your name for the record.
John Foshi, the city administrator of Proctor. Thank you for hearing us. Looked at this situation. Our current 0.5% is dedicated to pay for our community center and also for our streets. We've taken a look. We actively plan a comprehensive plan, and springing out of that comprehensive plan is a 5-year capital improvement program. Basically, looking at our 5-year capital improvement program, I've blown it out to 10 years, and that's why I established the $7.2 million. We are basically doing a lot of regional projects. One large regional project is a 1-mile stretch of new road with a above-grade crossing of the railroad tracks, which we need for public safety purposes, and also to a second entrance exit to the regional recreational facilities, which house the football and baseball fields for the school. So it's having one entrance exit is not the safest thing in the world. This would provide for that. We're part of the Western Superior Lake Sanitary District, so we'll be doing some upgrades to our sewer systems for that regional system. We're also part, we buy water from the city of Duluth, so the regional water system, we'll be doing some upgrades of the water infrastructure and also storm water. We're on top of the hill. We flow down to Lake Superior, so we're trying to protect that wonderful resource. So that just gives you kind of an idea, basically, of our needs and what regional projects that we would be using to fund, or this sales tax would fund. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Foshi.
Good morning. I'm Jake Benson. I own 3 businesses in Proctor, and I'm a former 2-term chamber president. I thank Chairman Bach and committee members. Good morning, and again, thank you for this opportunity. I'll try to keep my comments brief since you have 8 other items, and I've always been told to never miss an opportunity to keep my mouth shut. Proctor's always been a regional center. Proctor was created to serve the iron mining industry. We're connected to the Iron Range like an umbilical cord with our railroad tracks. We were the largest inland iron ore sorting yards in the world, yet we're not part of the Taconite tax relief area. Over 20% of Proctor's developed land is owned by the railroad, which is valued less than other industrial, commercial, residential properties. Railroad pays less than 50% of the property taxes as other commercial properties do. The railroad at one time employed over 4,500 people. Now that's down to 207. The railroad tracks cuts Proctor into pieces, makes large amounts of our property inaccessible, which has for years caused our properties to go tax forfeit. Same holds true with I-35 and Highway 2, which also cuts up our town. But yet we continue to grow as a regional center and a regional attraction. We have over 90,000 visitors a year spending the night in Proctor at one of our 3 motels. Visitors come from throughout the region to Proctor, and they come to visit our fairgrounds, our equine facility, our half-mile racetrack, our regional recreation center, our gun club golf course, and, of course, Spirit Mountain. Spirit Mountain is owned by the city of Duluth, which has 80 pr- prime acres, some of the most expensive property in Proctor, but yet because they're tax exempt, we get no property taxes from that. As Chairman Bach mentioned earlier, Proctor is bordered on three sides by two cities that have a sales tax, and this will help keep us in line with those communities. There's good reasons for us to have this local option sales taxes. Some communities need it more than others. Rest assured, Proctor is a very well-run city, better than most we have to be. The last time we came to seek for permission, our voters passed the referendum by 11-1 margin. And we hope you vote in favor of 1364 and in favor of Proctorites to make their own decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. Are there questions for the witnesses or Senator Bach? Senator Bach, without objection, will lay Senate file 1394 on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bach, would you like to do Senate File 820 next?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. As long as I'm here, let's get that out of the way in the interest of time.
Senator Bach, did you have some witnesses that wanted to join you at the table as well?
Mr. Chairman, I do.
I have all those as well. They're under here. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, this bill requires a withholding of 2% on 1099 employees who are independent contractors. This is a provision that the governor carried in his tax bill I believe in 2005, and it ended up, it was this payment plus an additional 2%, it included a 2% for out-of-state people that received 1099 employees, and in the conference committee, the only provision that ended up included was a 2% withholding for out-of-state 1099 holders. So this expands it to include all 1099 employees engaged in the construction industry. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I have a witness here. And members, I should just say this does generate a little bit of money for our bill, which will be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Bill Becker. I'm in the flooring business. I'm a second-generation company. My father started the company in 59, and a second generation, I've been involved in the flooring industry, and what we see happening is that for us, it's getting harder to compete against these people that don't seem to pay their fair share of business, of taxes, employment tax, work comp, and so on. We've as a business, 3 years ago, I look back, we have lost 30,000 employee hours from 3 years ago. We have lost $3.5 million worth of labor business because we cannot compete in our segment of the labor market anymore because of the prices being driven down by this type of employee or people, independent contractors, so to speak, coming in more frequently into our type of business, and it's just getting very tough to compete out there, and we just don't see it getting any better as an employer trying to hire people and grow our business in this segment of the market.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Becker, I don't know if I understood this competitive issue adequately. You say there's another employer that comes in, but how does withholding 2% income tax back that you as an employer would have to hold, you would have to handle the accounting procedures. There's going to be extra cost to you. Where's the competitive problem? I don't understand the link here.
Well, what I understand it to be, if I go to a retailer, a large retailer in town, and I contract labor. They sell a product, floor covering, and I give them a price to sell for my labor. Well, I have work comp taxes and business dollars that I need to support. What's happening out there is these people where I'm not going to be the person that call them legitimate or unlegitimate. They work out of their vans. They pull up to this retailer and they can cut our price by a dollar a yard or so many cents a square foot, and by them not having to or not being able to be traced to paying their full amount of their 1099s, which they get from this retailer, gives me a heck of a disadvantage because they don't have the same costs in the doing business that I have, and big costs are our employees and employee taxes and just paying the taxes from our employees, where they're many times they're not reporting their true full income, so to speak.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Becker, if everyone surfaces up to a new playing field where everyone has to be treated the same, kind of like they are now, you're still going to have that competitor working out of their van. And so if you have to withhold 2% of taxes for your employees, they're going to have to do the same thing. But in most cases, they just work for themselves. And even if they do that, I don't know how that improves your competitive edge with them, because everyone moves up to the same level. So there's really no competitive advantage or disadvantage for either one of you. This guy's still kind of reinventing the mousetrap to put the product out at a lesser cost. I guess I'm not understanding the competitive link here.
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, the issue for people like Mr. Becker is he runs employees subject to regular payroll overhead, right. FICA, workers' comp, unemployment comp. He has competitors who've made a decision to classify their employees as independent contractors. Mm-hmm. And they aren't subject to the same kind of payroll overheads that other employers are. What this bill does is requires that employer that's hiring independent contractors to withhold some money and send it to the state with the individual's name, address, Social Security number. I think that's the critical part of this, is now the Department of Revenue is going to know who all these 1099 employees are. Right now, revenue, if a person doesn't, the 1099s go on your federal tax return, but the Department of Revenue really can't get their arms around this whole misclassification issue and the fact that some people don't file. Legitimate independent contractors would file an income tax return if this provision was in law, because they would probably like to get back the 2% if they don't have any tax liability that was withheld from them. So this provision, I believe, and it was the reason it was probably included in the governor's budget, and I remember Commissioner Salamone talking about this in 2005, the department really doesn't know who all these independent contractors are out there. And this would give them a database. If withholding is withheld, they would have names, addresses, Social Security numbers, and these individuals, and someday I think we could create some kind of a pilot program at Revenue to do some additional compliance work once we know who all these individuals are. I think that's, Senator Limmer, what we're really trying to get our arms around is who are these people. Let's get their names, let's get their addresses, and so that if there is some under-reporting going on, Department of Revenue will be able to have the information they need to go out and try to get better compliance.
Senator Limmer.
Senator Bach, I hire people under a 1099, and I want to make sure I file my 1099s, because then I can write that expense off as a legitimate business expense. I'm hiring a service. from an independent contractor. Now, why can't, if we're looking for information for the revenue department, why can't the revenue department take my 1099s that I submit on my tax form and get all of the data on that individual that has been given that 1099 slip at the end of the year? They could accumulate all of the information that you're looking for through this bill off of the 1099 that a general contractor or another type of business would sign. So I'm wondering why what's the problem with the Department of Revenue that they can't accumulate all that data on all of the submitted 1099s as the payer would submit?
I think, Mr. Chairman, part of the problem, Senator Lemmerin, is everybody doesn't treat it as honestly as you do, and the department isn't getting all the information.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, it's a great incentive for the person paying for the service to file those 1099s. Otherwise, he has to pay. It would be considered as income, and he would have to pay tax on that income. So it's a very high incentive for the employer, in this case, for lack of a better term, to file that 1099. So that in and of it is, of itself, is the incentive to have all these thousands and millions of 1099s go down to the Department of Revenue. And I see that you have a threshold of $600, which is also the threshold for reporting any type of any type of service. It's kind of the threshold. You don't have to issue a 1099 if it's under $600. So I understand that. But quite often, I do know that some people will let's just say they won't have a single bill that ever exceeds $600. And that way they hope to get around, maybe they're paying it cash and getting a discount for the price of the service. And nobody files anything, including that person hiring the service. But I don't know if we're really going to get any more information than what the 1099s are already submitted for.
Well, Mr. Lemmerin, this is just an effort on my part to try and find some additional revenue in the compliance area, because, you know, having been involved in the construction industry for 30 years myself, I'm pretty well aware that we've got a compliance problem with a pretty big, probably a growing segment of the industry, certainly in shingle roofs and in drywall, probably in siding, likely in floor covering. And legitimate employers that I know are finding it difficult to compete when their competition is moving towards independent contractors. So I think we're just kind of trying to level the playing field up here, and hopefully we get some better compliance so that all the rest of us don't have to pay more because other people are finding ways to get around the tax system.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Lemmerin and members, if you go to the inside of this revenue explanation, there's a revenue analysis in here, and it says that for sole proprietors, the department's only link to their earned income is the 1099, and it's not submitted directly to the state. And by the time they get the tapes from the IRS, the data's very old, and there's a lot of questions about how complete it is. So this is an effort to bring more complete data to the state and address this issue that Senator Bach is trying to resolve with this bill.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? Any further discussion? Seeing none. Someone is coming forward. I'm sorry, I didn't see it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I think the material in our red folder also provides some more information about this subject. I've been perusing it. Helps illuminate the goal of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Jeff Shainwetter, and I'm a contractor here in the state of Minnesota, offices in Eden Prairie and Brainerd. I thank you for allowing me to share some concerns with this bill with you today. We we believe the systems to enforce the premise of this already exist. We look at the insurance industry and their policies that address this very issue through the annual employment tax audits, payroll tax audits. Our business and the business of many of my colleagues entertain an annual audit where neither the state nor the contractors need to duplicate the effort of the policing of this revenue event that already exists. That we believe that this is a duplication of effort that's going to be a burden on the contractors, and that the contractors themselves are not the correct resource for the state to use to collect revenue. That one of the examples I would share with you, in many cases, the actual contractor doesn't control the cash flow that would create the opportunity for the withholding event that this bill contemplates. Let me give you an example of that, that my company borrows much of its capital to develop real estate. And we borrow that from banks, and the banks prefer to control the cash flow events to the vendors, the subcontractors, the tradespeople that actually do the work. So therefore, if you're going to follow cash flow and look to the cash flow event to capture additional revenue for the state, you'd look to the title company, because the cash flow event is from the bank or the lender to the title company pursuant to lending practice in concert with Minnesota lien law. So the lien laws for the state of Minnesota require for the priority of a mortgage to be insured that the disbursements to the contractors be made by a disbursing agent, a licensed title company in the state of Minnesota. So bank policy requiring these disbursements for an insured loan through the title company is the one paying the vendors, and therefore the vendors or the contractors don't touch the cash and don't have the opportunity to create the withholding event in the majority of this circumstance. So I feel, and my colleagues feel in our industry, that the good guys who are in compliance with both federal and state rules don't need the additional burden for the contractors. We don't believe that this additional overhead is going to make housing more affordable. We believe it's going to make our overhead higher and therefore the cost of producing affordable homes more difficult. We'd like to suggest that this isn't the duty of the contractor.
Thank you, Mr. Shainwater. Is there further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, as you know, I may not be supporting this bill, but I do have a suggestion for an amendment on the bottom of the page, on page 1, lines 21 through 22. We're focusing on a contractor who is hiring someone, and it's simply referred to as the recipient's name, address, and Social Security number. Some of these independent contractors own businesses. They're filed as a corporation. They do their service under a corporate name. And you may want to consider, after recipient's name, placing into the language or business name, comma, and then after Social Security account number, comma, then submit or federal tax ID number. That way, you'd at least be focusing on both entities that may be doing that. But otherwise, I think the Department of Revenue may get a lot of confusion on the part of who's getting taxed, and there may be some tax considerations that are advantageous to either the individual and or the corporate title, depending on what the owner wants to do and how he wants to route his business accounting to whatever title he prefers.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think that's a reasonable suggestion. I would move that Senator Limmer's oral amendment, that on line 1.21, after the comma, insert or business name, comma. And on line 1.22, delete the period and insert or federal ID number, period.
Does everyone have Senator Bach's oral amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. If there's no further discussion, Senator Bach moves that Senate File 820, or that without any objection, we lay over 820 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Bach.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Thank you.
Thank you, members, for being willing to accommodate the city of Proctor. I think they probably came the furthest here today. I appreciate giving them an opportunity to get done early. Members, Senate File 884, if you look on your agenda, our first bill, we talked with Senator Youngbauer, who talked with the city of Anoka, and the city of Anoka has decided that this is maybe something better for us to consider next year. So Senator Youngbauer has requested that we withdraw Senate File 884 from consideration. Senator Sieben. Senate File 1136.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing Senate File 1136. This is a fairly simple but incredibly important bill for Washington County. It would exempt sales tax purchases on construction materials and equipment for the Washington County Courts facility that's currently under construction in Cottage Grove. And members, I've been told that this is the largest court facility construction projects going on in the state right now, and it's projected to be one of the largest for in the years to come too, for a good period of time. With me today to testify is Commissioner Gary Creasel, who's the chair of the Washington County Board.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for providing me the opportunity to come here before you today seeking your support on this bill. Washington County will be undertaking this year or beginning construction on a $50 million courts expansion project, which will be a three-story addition to our law enforcement center, a new 9/11 call center, and a five-story courts expansion. As you're probably all aware, the state funds the administration of the court system, and Washington County provides the facilities. Currently, we have 10 courtrooms, and we will be building 16 courtrooms by the year 2025. What Washington County has done good in the past and continues with this project is to build for today's needs but shell for the future with the anticipated growth. What this proposal will allow is for a $1.6 million reduction in our cost, the $50 million cost, and we would apply that to the furnishings and technology to the court system. This ultimately reduces the property tax needed for providing the state functions on our campus. What we're asking is, we appreciate the partnership we have with the state in the court system. We provide the facilities. And they fund the court's administration, and what we're asking is that we don't have to pay our partners the 6.5% sales tax.
Mr. Chair, the project is estimated to cost $49 million, and so the cost of the project to the state to exempt the sales tax would be about $1 million.
Question? Members? Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, thank you for coming today. I'm a former Carver County Commissioner, and Senator Steven, I think this is probably one of the best bills I've seen at the Capitol all year. And the reason why is I've carried the similar legislation for Carver County for the last several years. We're trying to build a courthouse in Carver County as well because the state court system is telling us we need more court facilities. I've been trying to get the sales tax exemption for Carver County as well so that the members of the public would not have to pay the financing costs and roll that into the bond, and I'm assuming that you're bonding your building. If you don't get the sales tax exemption, what happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, obviously we're not probably going to be doing everything that we had liked to do. You know, at some point you have to make we're certainly not going to compromise security. This is a very important project that addresses security concerns and court's efficiencies. What we're asking for is the exemption that so it doesn't have to fall back on the backs of our taxpayers, that we're partners in this and that the state would recognize that and exempt us from the sales tax so it doesn't have to fall in the backs of our taxpayers. We certainly will not compromise the project in regards to safety and efficiency and things like that, because they are important. With the judges have we've had great committee work with them making sure that we address those concerns.
Mr. Chair.
Members, there is a fiscal note in your packet that shows that the cost of this bill is $800,000 in FY09, an additional $800,000 in FY10. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Steven, would you support making this exemption available for all construction for all courthouses across the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, in theory, I'd be happy to support any bill that comes forward that does that. At this time, though, I'd just like to keep this bill just focused on Washington County because the need is immediate, and they want to begin, or they're beginning construction very soon. In the future, I give you my word that I will support a bill that you bring forward that does that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to join Senator Ortman. It's being a former county commissioner that has carried legislation for their county to exempt them from sales tax on their court facilities. And I wasn't successful in my effort, but I do wish you luck. I think that the fiscal ramifications for the state are quite large.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to add fire stations to the list.
Senator Dibble.
I'll express my support as well for Senator Ortman's bill. We got a bunch of folks to convince. Just a quick question for Commissioner. Nice to see you again today. We're working pretty hard, it looks like. We were out at the town hall meeting last night. Commissioner was with us to talk about transit. And we'll get transit out there to serve this campus. Is this whole campus being under construction? Are there existing buildings that are being added to? I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, the portion, the five-story addition is this portion here, and you can see the courts, the law enforcement center expansion is just a.
I see.
Not, okay. This is not the whole move.
Oh, okay. I was impressed at the size of this construction. Okay, I get it. Thanks.
As long as we're spending, members, if we can afford it, I'd like to express my support for St. Louis County's courthouse project. Hang on to your wallets out there in the audience.
Mr. Chair, could we make that retroactive? Senator Scoy and I have got facilities in our district didn't get it, so maybe 10 years retroactive, maybe?
Sure.
Mr. Chair?
There is a very legitimate concern that the state is requiring counties to build, you know, additional facilities, and then we're subjecting those local units of government to the sales tax. Senator Day brought that issue to us some time ago. Senator Moss?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a county courthouse proposal, but I'd be glad to trade my vote on that for something else.
Senator Moss, spoken like a ranger.
You just didn't know it.
Any other questions? Senator Seaman, thank you. Mr. Creasel, thank you very much for coming in. Without objection, Chair lays over Senate File 1136 for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Seaman, why don't you stay right there, and we'll take up Senate File 1139.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate File 1139 would exempt from sales tax materials used in construction and maintenance of roads and bridges for counties and cities or local units of government that are generally subject to the sales tax. And although we sort of had a chuckle about all the different entities that would like to be exempt from the sales tax, I think the construction materials have a legitimate concern here, whereby they are not exempt from the sales tax, yet costs for construction of roads and bridges and transportation projects are increasing so much. Also, I should note that as more costs are being pushed on to local units of government for construction costs, for instance, more property taxes are increasingly being used in counties around the state to pay for road projects. I think that there's a serious policy discussion that needs to happen about what the state is taxing different units of government to complete various projects in construction projects. This obviously also has an even more significant fiscal impact for the state, but with me today to talk about the need for this is Keith Carlson from the Metropolitan Inter-County Association.
To the fiscal note, members, it's in your packet. FY08, $26.9 million. FY09, $30.3 million. And the tails are even larger. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I make my comments, I guess I do want to address the fiscal note. I have asked the Department of Revenue, I saw it this morning for the first time, to review the fiscal note. It's not clear from the write-up whether they're using all the county, cities, road and bridge expenditures to make this, or just the portion that's attributable to materials. If they've used all of our expenditures, the fiscal note's in error because that would include our costs for other than construction materials. This note is nearly four times larger than a similar proposal that was considered back in the 2001 session. Mr. Chairman, then going on to my comments, I'm here today to testify in support of Senator Stevens 1139. As you no doubt know, local governments have been frustrated about being subject to the sales tax ever since the tax was imposed on them in 1991, but doubly so with regards to the sales tax on construction materials, since we've seen no increase in our aid or our share of the gas tax and motor vehicle registration tax since the last time the legislature increased those taxes back in 1988. Compounding that is substantial increases that have occurred in the materials we use for constructing and maintaining our roads and bridges. in just the period from 2003 to 2005, those costs went up nearly 20%. In the most recent year, we've seen asphalt costs go up nearly 40%. So we're undergoing some exorbitant cost increases, and as a consequence, are suffering in our ability to maintain our existing facilities, much less being able to construct new facilities. The governor has, part of his budget, has proposed exempting the State Department of Transportation from the sales tax for trunk highway expenditures. I guess the counties, as well as the cities and townships, are here today to say us too. Thank you for your consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, we also have with us today John Masco. Did I pronounce that correctly? The city engineer of St. Paul.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak to the bill. My name is John Masco. I'm the city engineer with St. Paul. St. Paul maintains an estimated $2.6 billion, that's with a B, worth of public works infrastructure that contributes to our neighborhood livability and our citizens' quality of life. St. Paul has 851 miles of street, 85 miles of which are 10% that are still oil or dirt, believe it or not, for a city our age. 2,300 alleys, 1,000 miles of sidewalk, 370 traffic signals, and 31,000 streetlights. We have an annual operating budget of $121 million and a capital budget of $32 million. So what would passing this bill mean for St. Paul? We looked at 2005 data, and one of our most requested programs is our Residential Street Vitality Reconstruction Program. It actually works to make these oiled and dirt streets paved roads with curb, gutters, street lights, and a paved roadway. And we attempt to reconstruct 10 miles of street annually. That actually puts our local roads on about a 60-year reconstruction cycle, if in fact we can make that. In 2005, the city of St. Paul paid $55,377 in tax alone just on salt for winter street maintenance. If this bill were passed, it's estimated that the tax savings on materials alone would allow us to put $950,000 to $1 million more into our street system. That could mean about a 10% increase in our street reconstruction program, or about another 8 blocks of curb, street light, and asphalt, helping to improve our neighborhood vitality and protect the environment with better runoff management. It could also complete 10 substantial traffic calming projects in the neighborhoods. Could resurface a street such as Trunk Highway 5 or West 7th Street from the river or the West City limits to Randolph Avenue, or in comparison, a local arterial street, Grand Avenue, its full length curb to curb from the College of St. Thomas to downtown St. Paul. Construct 5 new traffic signals, add 150 new driver feedback signs, reminding motorists of their exorbitant speed. Paint our signal and light poles on a 6-year cycle as opposed to the current 20-year cycle. And in the environment outdoor that they're in, I'd equate it to your home without the salt and road splash and everything else that hits those poles. With that, we strongly support the exemption. Help us put more dollars to work, actually improving our neighborhoods with stuff that our residents can see on the street. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maxwell. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Senator Sieben and the witnesses raised a point, a really good point, and this point similar to what you raised about the courthouses, that decisions are causing local units of government to pick up more and more of the transportation freight than they have in the past. We've had some very compelling testimony in front of the Transportation Committee, and seen certainly a lot of information out in the media about how local units of government are actually doing a great deal of the construction
particularly on those major arterials, the county roads, the municipal state aid streets, as well as, you know, when state highway improvements are coming through, all of the accessory and access improvements that, that locals have to pick up that were previously shared by the state. Everyone on the Transportation Committee, I think, is very tuned into that subject. Senator Skoy, moi, Langseth, Ortman, myself. The point is very similar to the previous bill.
Senator Ortman.
Chair, in short, we should be doing it. I just don't think we're going to have the money to do it. I'm hoping we can add local roads and bridges to our capital bonding bill, a bigger percentage of it, so that we can at least get that money out. It seems to me that it's of statewide significance for all of our communities to have additional funds for local roads and bridges, and I for one, would like to see our capital bonding bill expanded for that purpose this year and next year as well. If we can support, I will support this if there's sufficient finances available to do it, and I think it's a little disappointing that the governor didn't include this, because he gets it that we need to exempt sales tax on road construction for the bonding bill and for light rail, but not local roads and bridges. And I think there's an inconsistency there that we should correct at the legislature if we can.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if I guess Senator Sieben, did I hear Mr. Carlson say that this fiscal note might be four times more than it was in 01? And is somebody requesting the department to revisit that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, yes, I spoke to the department this morning. Revenue analysis prepared back in 2001 had the cost of a similar proposal, but not quite as broad, has it excluded contractor purchases, costing $6.9 million in the first year and $7.6 million. What caused me to be concerned about it is the write up on the note references that use the state auditor's figures for capital outlay and current expenditures for road and bridges. Some of that is for construction and maintenance materials, but a significant portion is for exempt activities such as the payroll for our personnel and other things that would not be covered by this. So I've asked them to re-examine it and revise the note if appropriate.
Okay, and Mr. Chair,
as
you mentioned, when we had the Senator Day's bill dealing with local sales tax here, you know, this was a trade-off that was made, reductions in LGA or pay sales tax on your equipment. But as we have the aid discussion in the property tax division or in full committee later on probably, maybe the advocates would want to revisit that thought, and, you know, we could conceivably consider changing some of the aid proposals to include the sales tax exemption if the committee thinks that's a more efficient way to provide property tax relief.
Mr. Manson? I guess the chair joins in the request of Keith Carlson that you take a look at this fiscal note on Senate File 1139 and just make sure that it's accurate. Or do you have any comment on that?
I did call back to the office, and we think it only includes material, but we'll take a second look at it, and okay. We're open for better information out there, too.
Okay.
Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You. Senator Johnson.
On that point, I'd like to also add in Mr. Carlson's testimony, he did say that the costs of construction have gone up 4% or four times over the last several years. So the fiscal note, I do support the bill, but we should be prepared that the fiscal note may be correct.
Right. It's possible. Senator Sieben, do you have another testifier?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Rob Vanosik from the townships would like to testify.
Welcome. Good morning, members. My name is Rob Vanosik with the Minnesota Association of Townships. Minnesota's townships are strongly in favor of this legislation. Although townships are exempt partially from the gravel tax, there was provision in the department's technical bill that came through this committee earlier this session that would have alleviated some of that confusion. Right now, when gravel is only tax exempt when it's spread directly, deposited in its final play location, and is spread immediately. If it's stored or if a contractor is confused about how to do the paperwork at the area of point of sale, those costs do get borne by the taxpayers of the townships. Townships have seen their levies statewide double in the past from 2000 to 2004. The amount townships are levying for road expenditures, and townships do have 59,000 miles of roads more. They're responsible for more miles of road than any other entity in the state, including the state itself. A few of the members on the committee have heard our testimony in local property, the tax division, in the transportation committee, and have heard a number of our concerns. The town, the road levy amount, townships have increased their amount for the past 4 years, year over year, by about 25% each year. Last year it was 26% more than the year previous. And we've suffered kind of a trifecta over the last decade and a half. The sales tax on local governments was imposed back in the early 90s. In 2001, townships lost all LGA and homestead agriculture credit assistance. And now with the cost of road construction maintenance going up and no increase in the amount of money coming from the state helping with road infrastructure, townships have put the cost of road maintenance onto their residents. So we'd strongly support this bill and stand for questions.
Thank you. Members, anything else? Without objection, the chair lays over Senate File 1139 for possible inclusion in the committee's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Stephen. Senator Lynch here. She's in another committee. Is the let's take up the two small Senator Pogemiller's not here, so we have two small department bills. Senate File 1024. I know we have someone from the department here to speak to that. And members, Senate File 1024 has been requested by the Judiciary Committee, so we'll have the department go through what's in here, and then this one we will have to move to Judiciary. I expect that once they look at it, we'll get it back, but welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Wayne Sather. I'm an employee at the Department of Revenue. I am here to speak to Bill 1024, and if you'd like, should I just run through the sections?
Go ahead. Tell us what it does.
Pardon me?
Yeah. Go ahead and just tell us what the bill does.
What the bill does is it streamlines collection, the 16 chapter 16D collection chapter a bit, and it makes a couple of small changes to make it more efficient for the state to do certain things. And it's all the sections are pretty much unrelated. They're all about different things. For example, the first section, the prime reason for the first section is that the bill, the chapter, since it was enacted, has jumped back and forth between the terms state agency and referring agency. And the concern of the chapter is essentially referring agencies, agencies that refer debt for collection. So we tried in several of the sections that change is made is to change to referring. And the second section, there were a couple of reasons for the second section. One was to guarantee that referring agencies would refer their debts electronically. And it's my understanding that virtually all of them already do. So I don't anticipate a lot of resistance to that. Also, there was some doubt by referring agencies in the past as to whether or not they could refer debt prior to 120 days old. And we're trying to clarify that you can refer it when you're ready at 120 days it becomes mandatory, but before that it's permissive. And the bill, the chapter since its enactment has had lots of amendments, and in the second section there's another case where we're clarifying that the Commissioner of Finance is not there, it's the Commissioner of Revenue now. That change was made several years ago. The sections 3 and 4 have to do with the collection costs, and I anticipate that there is some interest in this. In the past, since this bill was enacted, there was a two-tier collection cost. Debts coming in came in at a 15% fee, and if they required enforced collection action, they went to a 25% fee. And we're trying to eliminate that two-tier thing, or it's just a flat fee, and anticipating your questions about this, in 2005, the last year that I have the data for, the actual fee collected came in at 19.64%, and based on the cost, it would have been 18.8%, and we're asking for 17% to start. And the second, Section 4, the rate is supposed to be based on costs, and so it may become necessary to adjust the costs at some time. So we decided to leave that in and clarify that the Commissioner of Revenue would be doing that adjusting. Hopefully, with economies of scale, et cetera, the adjustments will be downward. That would be our wish. Section 5, the tax chapters have been recodified several times in the last 15 years. And in those recodifications, for example, 1990, et cetera, the penalties, which used to be in separate chapters, were put in 289, Chapter 289A on that recodification in 1990. And since then, there's been kind of a semantic problem with the way the chapters are worded. So we're in Section 5, we're just trying to clarify that in the last recodification, which was 2 years ago to 270C, they lost a further track of the penalties, and we're trying to clarify that penalties for late payment will be covered by personal liability. Personal liability would be assessable for late payment. In the final section, Section 6, is a section that provides for transcription of liens from the Secretary of State to the various counties. Transcription is only necessary when a debt gets to the age where you can't file an original lien. And in this case, for tax debts, which this is, that's 5 years. And in the past, if you wanted to move a lien between counties, that was simple. After 5 years, you could move the lien. You didn't get more time. You just got the lien in a new place. And there's never been a provision that you could transcribe from the Secretary of State to the various counties. So we're putting that in there. And anticipating a question of that, this will cost the Secretary of State nothing. The department takes care of this whole transaction, files lien transcription forms in the county of destination. That's the bill in a very short nutshell.
Thank you, Mr. Sadler. Senator Moy, I understand your committee would like to see this bill.
Mr. Chair, the bill is scheduled to be heard in the Data Practices Subcommittee tomorrow morning, and then we'll send it back to you.
Yep. Any other questions from members of the committee? Senator Moy moves that Senate File 1024 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary,
aye.
No motion prevails. Bill is passed. Senator Lynch. Thank you, Mr. Sadler.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lynch, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you very much, Senator
Bob. Which
Bob.
Bill would you like to take first?
I'd like to begin with Senate File 830.
Okay.
And
very well.
I would ask that my testifiers come forward and join me at the table. Mr. Chair and members, I'm pleased to appear before the Tax Committee this morning for my first time. This is now my third bill of the morning, the three of five. So with that, I assure you that my remarks here will be very brief. But simply put, Senate File 830 is an immigration tax credit for citizenship. And my interest in this particular piece of legislation stems from the fact that I believe collectively that we agree that some of the problems and trials and tribulations facing our immigration system in this country are federal issues. At the same time, and noting that, I view this bill as something that we as a state can do to assist in further addressing this. I believe that anything that we can do to encourage and help support the path to citizenship is not only good public policy, but it reflects and represents those Minnesota core values and give credence to support future workforce in this state and in this country. At this time, I'd like to ask John Keller, the Executive Director for Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota, to provide some specifics on the details of the bill, and I have a couple additional testifiers after that, Mr. Chair.
And members, there is a fiscal note in here in your packet. This bill costs in FY08 $4 million, FY09 $4.4 million, and in 10 and 11 the number gets larger. So you might want to review that bill summary and the fiscal note. Thank you.
Mr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's my great pleasure to be here and have an opportunity to share a little bit about my passion, which is working with this.
Mr. Keller, if you'd give us your name and who you represent for the record.
Sorry about that. I'm John Keller from the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota. I'm
Thank
the executive
you.
Director there.
Welcome to the Tax Committee.
As I was saying, it's my great pleasure to share my passion in working with the state's newest Minnesotans, its immigrants and refugees. Today I'd like to talk about Senate File 830 and testify in favor of it. I first give my thanks on behalf of my office and the many people who will benefit from this to Senator Lynch, to Senators Rose and Larson, Higgins and Scheid, who are also co-sponsors. I stand or sit here in front of you today as the Executive Director of the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota. Over the last 10 years, we've represented over 20,000 immigrants and refugees with their cases here in Minnesota. We represent people at the height of citizenship matters, which is citizenship and everything else. It is the happiest sort of work that we do to help people become citizens of the United States. My testimony today is going to be in two parts. First of all, to try to explain what is very confusing area of the law and also to reaffirm the importance of this piece of legislation today. I believe wholeheartedly that the importance of sending a positive message through the power of this committee and through the power of state government to Minnesota's immigrants and refugees is very important today. The immigrant and refugee community in Minnesota and throughout the United States is in the focus of many, many different pieces of press. Unfortunately, many of them are negative recently, the most recent situation being what played out yesterday in New Bedford, Connecticut. Citizenship and this bill helps a certain sector of the legal immigrant community and refugee community, persons who already have their legal residence, who have been here 5 years or more, who are persons of good moral character, and who have decided that they want to become full-fledged citizens of the United States with the obligations and protections of the U.S. Constitution. As I mentioned, the importance of becoming a citizen and what we talk to our clients a fair number of times over and over again, or they tell us, are the following. By promoting citizenship in the United States, and when I talk to clients when they decide to become citizens, these are the main reasons it makes sense for the state to be involved and it makes sense for an individual to become a citizen. By becoming a U.S. citizen, in other words, by transitioning from a green card holder or a legal permanent resident into a U.S. citizen, you can protect your family and you can unify them. You can bring them from abroad if they're waiting in a refugee camp or if they're waiting in their home country in a much faster amount of time. A petition by a permanent resident can take up to 8 years or more to reunite your spouse or small children. On the other hand, a petition by a U.S. citizen can take as short as 6 months or a year and a half average to reunite your family. Your minor children who have permanent residence already at the day you become a citizen, for example, Mr. Ibrahim, his citizenship test swearing in is next Wednesday. Any minor children you have who have green cards automatically acquire U.S. citizenship. So it's not only something that you're doing in supporting the applicants in front of you, but you're also protecting and ensuring citizenship for your minor children. You can, of course, vote and expect the protections of the U.S. Constitution. You can't yet become president of the United States. But the governor of California may be trying to change that.
Yes.
You can be hired, in their support perhaps in the committee, you can be hired for federal jobs. There are certain federal jobs that require U.S. citizenship. You can obtain scholarships and certain loans for higher education. You, of course, can travel on the safest protection, the U.S. passport, in many countries, the safest in many countries is what I meant to say. You can and an important piece for many of our clients, especially those who have come from a place where they've been persecuted, is finally with a U.S. passport, you are able to travel home. You're able to travel home. Many times, loved ones have passed away. You have not seen family members for years and years. And in many of our clients' cultures, the need to pay respect and to be able to travel home in safety to do that is something that weighs on them constantly.
Mr. Keller, I think we need to kind of narrow your comments, if we can, to kind of to the tax implications of the bill would be helpful.
The comments specific to the tax implications in the context of the broader policy of sending a message of supporting immigrants is, I think it's confusing. I've looked at the fiscal note. I received it late yesterday. Basically, what this bill allows working class immigrants to do is to file for citizenship and to be reimbursed for those costs. Currently, the cost to file for citizenship, the application fee and the fingerprinting or biometric fee cost each applicant $400. That is the main cost and the principal cost that will be reimbursed for a portion of the applicants. And if you look at the bill, that portion is anyone who is under 200% of the federal poverty guideline. What is not included in the bill but is part of my expertise in working in this area, excuse me, it's also not reflected in the fiscal note, is that for the very low income, the disabled, many people who have suffered trauma, there already exists a fee waiver application program with the U.S. government, and people will be included under that. They would not be reimbursed for costs two times. In just wrapping up, I just want to thank you for this opportunity. I'll answer any questions you have. Perhaps after Mr. Ibrahim has a chance to briefly share why this would be important to him.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few quick questions. Senator Lynch, do you know what the salary figure is that represents 200% of the federal poverty level?
Yes. Senator Limmer, Mr. Chair. Realizing that that depends on the size of the family unit, let me, as an example, a family of four, 200% of poverty, represents
$40,000. Well, Senator Limmer, on the revenue analysis on the bill, we have that information. Federal poverty level for a family of four in 2007 was $20,650, so we're talking about roughly twice that.
$40,000. Mr. Chair, to your witness.
Senator Limmer.
Sir, could you tell me, are there any other states that offer this type of a program as what's being proposed here today?
That was one thing I was going to try to find out, and I have not I have not had time to find out if they're doing that.
Thank you. Senator Lichtman, we should have your next witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My next witness, Abdullahi Ibrahim.
Yes. My name is Abdullah Ibrahim. I've been in U.S. since 1990. Thank you for give us opportunity to talk about my family and other relatives, and my English is not that good. Thank you for you give me an opportunity today. Just helping with the translation.
Sure, sure. Mr. Ibrahim, you're doing fine.
Okay. I'm the father of 12 children, and 11 they are in here in this state. They are working, except one is getting 16 this year, and she is in the high school. And I pay for citizenship, 400. I apply about three times. And I'm going to be citizen on 14, coming Monday. And I'm thanking full for my lawyer and my government, state. And I need help with that money I paid. And my family, they didn't get all of them. They didn't become citizen, all of them. And they applied behind me. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mr.
Ibrahim. Thank you for coming to the committee today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Senator Lynch, one more witness.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I've asked my additional testifier to yield her time to me, and with that, I would move that Senate file.
Senator Lynch, you have to be a member of the committee to make a motion.
I'm sorry. Excuse me for my overindulgence. I aspire to be a member of this committee.
Why?
Senator Lynch, you should probably watch us in the next month, because some of the votes we take, you probably won't want to have to take. Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair, just so Senator Lynch doesn't feel bad, I voted on a bill that I presented in committee where I was not a member the other day, so... With five bills up today, I think you are given that latitude. Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to ask Mr. Keller to answer this question, because I think it's really important to point out if you're a parent and you have minor children and you're successful at becoming a citizen, what happens to the citizenship status of your children who are not born in this country, Mr. Keller?
it can become a complicated analysis, but the simplest way to explain it is where the children already have their green cards, their permanent residence, and one of the parents becomes a U.S. citizen automatically, even without filing paperwork, those minor children all become U.S. citizens. It's an extremely important provision of the law that that does what it should. It covers people who, for all intents and purposes, are citizens, even if they don't get those papers filed.
So, Mr. Chair, members, that's why this is really important, because then we're not, in a way, if we help the parents to achieve that, then any children who are minor children receive that benefit. And I was a beneficiary of that. When I was in sixth grade, my parents became citizens, and I didn't have to individually go through a citizenship process myself.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Scott.
Well, just briefly, Mr. Chair, and probably Senator Lynch, I listened to the testimony, and he said there is a way to waive this fee that's listed in the revenue analysis. And so I thinking is perhaps the revenue analysis is a little high. Is anybody going to double-check and kind of get some closer numbers on those as we move along?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scow, as I said, just saw the fiscal note yesterday, and this morning was asking the best way to go about doing that. So I will point out what are my observations. As I pointed out, this provision or this piece of legislation and your consideration really is for everybody who is not above 200%, and then who's 200%, I would say down to probably 100% of the federal poverty guideline. People who are on some sort of government benefit almost always will have their fees waived, and that's not included in the fiscal note. The other additional piece, if you'll indulge me, that as I looked at it, there are cost estimates for English classes as well as citizenship classes, and it's not my area of expertise, but all of our clients take English classes for free as far as I'm aware of it, and that would be something else that I'd point out to the fiscal note.
Well, Mr. Chair, if there is updated numbers, we'd appreciate getting it to the committee.
Absolutely.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know the witness's name. Professor?
John Keller, sorry.
Mr. Keller. Just one background question I wanted to ask is there any provision in federal law that if a person is coming to the United States to immigrant here, but let's say they're a person of wealth or perhaps a person who wants to move their business to the United States, is there any special considerations given to them? Are their fees waived, or can they make a payment fee to enter the country and have, let's say, specialized treatment if they're bringing that type of asset to the United States? Do you know of anything like that? I had heard that something like that was going on for people that were of means. And,
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, what you may have heard is something that's been in the news recently. The USCIS, the agency in charge of immigration services now, is introducing a series of fee increases for all applications, and one of the things that they intend to take away are the ability for people of means or applications for immigrants of means to receive fee waivers for the traditional fees that they would have to pay. What remains eligible for fee waivers include this sort of an application, an N-400 citizenship application.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator, go ahead.
Real briefly, Mr. Chair, our Cracker Jack staff, Ms. Hegstrom, pulled out a revenue estimate of April 5, 2006, and that's $1.1 million and $1.2 million per year, so significantly less, and it looks like it's covering the same thing. So I'll get this to Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, I'd like
to. Does it say, Senator Scoy, how many applicants they consider? Is the difference the number of applicants potentially in the fiscal note?
Doesn't address the number here.
The number in the current note says there were 15,456 immigrants admitted to Minnesota in 05. Yours has an earlier number, probably.
Yeah, this has, yes, this has half as many immigrants, 7,713.
Well, that's part of the reason.
That's part of it.
Senator,
but, Mr. Chair, there's a delay time between your admission and when you can apply for citizenship, so that raw number of 15,000 doesn't necessarily apply immediately. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the bill when the time is appropriate.
Senator Moi moves that Senate File 830 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill without objection. Thank you, Senator Lynch. Thank you, Mr. Abraham and Mr. Keller.
Thank you.
Senator Lynch, why don't you just stay right at the table and tell us about Senate File 782.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Delighted to continue. Senate File 782, and at this time, if my testifiers would join me at the table. Senate File 782 speaks to address jobs and development in some of our small cities across the state. I think often people associate me most commonly with my constituency based in Rochester. I will note that while that is a significant portion of my constituency, I also represent a great number of small towns and communities in the surrounding area. And what this bill does in its simplest form is create some opportunities for small cities in a pretty narrow scope to bring jobs, revitalization, and development to those small cities. I think the best example that I can give is perhaps of a small grocery store that may be enticed to open in one of those small cities. I think it's equally important to suggest not only what the bill is for, but what the bill doesn't do. The bill clearly addresses a very small, narrow, specific need. This is not for the Walmarts of the world. This is not for all cities. But as I visited with those small cities in my district, and I think that their needs and concerns that they shared are not unique to Senate District 30, but I think for members that have small cities in their constituencies, that I would suggest that you would hear the same thing. The choice before us today is there something that we can do to help those small cities, to help them create jobs, to help them keep some vitality in their communities, given, granted, acknowledging that there is an expense to doing that. But I would suggest to you that for that investment, if you will, the long-term payoffs, not only for those communities but for this state, will be rewarded. And with that, I would like to ask Jen O'Rourke to make some additional comments.
Ms. O'Rourke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. And I just wanted to be here to let you know that we're fine with this piece of legislation and have worked on it, if you will, over the past couple of years when it's been brought to you on this in this body as well as on the House side to get word out to our membership and talk to different cities about how this bill might affect them. A lot of you are familiar with our League of Minnesota Cities Bulletin. It's a weekly newsletter. We've written up on this bill a number of occasions, and when cities have had issues on it, we were able to help link up Representative Welty, actually, with those cities, and he did address some of those concerns, and that's why you see that bordering abutting language in the bill. That's all I have to say. I know Dave Engstrom with the Small Cities is here to offer some comments as well.
Thank you, Ms. O'Rourke. Mr. Engstrom.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be here. The Minnesota Association of Small Cities represents about 370 cities, all less than 5,000 population, mostly in rural Minnesota. We are supportive of this bill. The way we look at it, it merely levels a playing field amongst cities, simply removes the 10-mile radius issue. There are a lot of small cities, just like in the issue of 5,000 versus 10,000 is kind of an arbitrary number, as is the 10-mile arbitrary number. But there are a number of small cities that have need for revitalization and would love to use the tool of TIF in order to help revitalize their community. And we are supportive of the bill, and thanks, Senator Lynch, for introducing it.
There are questions. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lynch, maybe your witnesses could answer this question for me. Now that if this would pass into law, this new definition, would we be making any cities ineligible for TIF that are eligible now as maybe an unintended consequence by the change in definition?
Ms. O'Rourke?
Mr. Chair, if you will, Jenna O'Rourke with the League of Cities. I can't answer that question, but I saw Ms. Zellner shaking her head no. Maybe she could comment further.
Right. Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, this bill, the Revenue Department estimates that 113 small cities will become eligible to be treated as small cities under this legislation, and I can't imagine a circumstance where a city would be a larger city but still not within 10 miles of it. So I think that just as a practical matter, we're not going to make anyone ineligible for this definition.
Senator Skoy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to thank Senator Lynch for bringing this forward. I've worked on this issue some in the past, and it really is an issue for some of these small communities to maintain their downtown viability. And I think this is an effort that is worthy of our consideration as we move forward. And I had an opportunity to spend some time this fall in Rochester. I went to Eota and took a little look around. Hope that we're able to do something in this area.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I'm not a big fan of TIF, but I think this is kind of an equitable issue. Why these communities, I understand the need, and I'm not a big fan of TIF, but this seems to be just a matter of equity. So.
Thank you, Senator Marty. I'm agreeing with you more and more every day.
That's scary.
It can be a very scary issue.
A convert.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask Ms. Zellner if she could clarify something about what you said earlier. Is this going to affect like a township that maybe isn't prepared to become a city?
Ms. Zoff.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, no. The small city definition that's in current law and that remains unchanged actually applies just to a home rule charter or statutory city. So it would not apply to a township. It wouldn't give a township any TIF powers that it doesn't already have.
But, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Zellner,
Senator Johnson,
this won't accelerate or put them in a different situation, bracket, or definition, then it will keep them exactly the way they want to be.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, with respect to townships, yes, there will be no change whatsoever. This will only affect cities that are closer than 10 miles to distant from a city with a population over 10,000. That's the only change in this definition.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Senator Limmer, if you can.
Thank you. The last line of questioning raises an interesting question. Now, townships are eligible for TIF, but I think, at least in the one that I got involved in not too long ago, we had to make an economic development zone to qualify for TIF. And I don't know if, would it hurt this bill if we added townships to the eligibility of, as a political subdivision to this bill? Do you know?
Ms. Zoff. And then we're going to, we'll have to move on because we have one more bill we have to get to.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Senator Limmer.
This is quite an important issue for my district because in Hennepin County, there's one township that I represent left in the in the county of Hennepin, and that would be Hassan. And it surrounds the city of Rogers, and it abuts other cities that have a population of 10,000 or more. And so that's why I'm asking this line of questioning. And we probably don't have time to expand it, but I'll talk with the author and her witnesses and our counsel to determine if there's any type of provision that we might be able to do to maybe include a unique definition, at least for a particular township that's in the metropolitan area.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I know there are some limited circumstances under which townships can get involved in TIF districts. Without doing some more research on that, I don't believe that this bill is going to affect the township's ability in any way, but I'd like to take some more time before we deal with this again and get back to you on that.
No, I understand. Can we take it?
Is that it, members? Without objection, Chair lays over Senate File 782 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senator Pogemiller had to leave, but he's got some people from out of town here. Thank you, Senator.
Senator Bach, members, thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Yeah. Senate File 385, the historic tax credit issue, has been in front of us before. I think we know this issue well enough to proceed. It's been in front of this committee for a number of years. Senator Pogemiller indicated he was comfortable with us hearing the bill without him here. So Senator Moi is on the committee. She's here. So anyway, the chair brings up Senate File 385. So on the bill, we have three people on our list that would like to testify. Maybe Mr. Kelleher?
Just set him there. We'll get somebody to pass.
Mr. Kelleher here?
Yes.
Mr. Kelleher, why don't you give us a little rundown of what's in the bill, and then we'll have the testifiers. I'm sure you know the bill well.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. In brief, what this bill does is provides a tax credit for property owners who rehabilitate qualified historic structures. It's designed to parallel an existing federal tax credit program that's been in place for over 30 years. Across the country, billions of dollars in investment has been made in historic structures, and those historic structures really help to provide economic development benefits for cities and small towns across the state, as well as providing some community pride and community identity. Mr. Chairman, that's the briefest of descriptions. I know, as you pointed out, that the committee has heard this before, and we'd be happy to answer any detailed questions, and the testifiers also have a few words to say.
And members, we don't have a current fiscal note on this yet. There is one in your packet from last year, from April 2006, and it showed that in the first year the cost was $4.7 million. So that would be, in this case, that would be FY09. And then the numbers increase in the out years beyond that. When we get a more current fiscal note, we'll make it available. For witnesses?
I'm Rich Carlson. I'm city administrator at Little Falls, and we passed out some information on our historic district and some of the things we've been doing in Little Falls. Just very briefly, we have a lot of historic buildings in Little Falls. It's been a struggle to rehabilitate them, but we've been somewhat successful. We also passed out a policy that the city council has implemented with our Heritage Preservation Commission. And I'll just briefly mention the payback that we've noticed in this. The city council, in the good days, had $50,000 a year for heritage preservation and historic preservation for commercial buildings. We had a grant program for 30% of a project was grant, and the remaining 60% was a no-interest loan, and the owners had to come in with a 10% equity. We were able to rehabilitate one or two buildings downtown a year. We still have many to go. But the payback we've noticed, the city council's noticed the payback on this is about 2 to 3 years. None of them extended beyond 5 years. So economic development-wise, this has been a good program for the city. There just is not enough money. $50,000 sounds like a lot, but when you get doing some of these old buildings, it just didn't have a big impact, one building at a time. Dwayne Bobick, our new council member, is also here from the city council.
One thing I would say
Please state your name.
My name is Dwayne Bobick. I'm a council member in the Little Falls Council. And I'd say, just look around you. Our heritage. And basically, what we have in Little Falls is a lot of old homes, some very historical stuff, having to do with logging. Of course, Lindbergh House there, Dewey Radke, that aided and did a lot for the town. But I say, too, as you delegate to us, look at the building that you are in. This is our history. And if we do not keep our history, we're gone. And that's one of the big issues with me and why I actually decided to run for council was the fact that so many people in the town are elderly, and this is their history. This is their life.
Mr. Bobick, thank you.
Thank you.
One more witness.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Roger Brooks, and I'm a member of the Board of Advisors of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and I was formerly president of the Minnesota Preservation Alliance, which is the statewide historic preservation organization. I think you have a packet that looks something like this. I hope you do. It has a lot of material, background information regarding this proposal, which, Mr. Chairman, as you said, you've heard many times. In fact, I think this committee has passed this proposal or one very much like it 6 times. So this is our 7th try, and we hope this will be our lucky year. Included in this packet is a letter from Richard Moe, who is president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and incidentally a Minnesota native who cares very much about Minnesota history. Among other things, he was the author of a history of the Minnesota First in the Civil War. Among other things, he says in the letter that's included here, he emphasizes the economic development impact of this proposal. It obviously is designed to save historic buildings, but it has a tremendous spin-off for any state that adopts this kind of thing. He says on page 2, the state's investment as a rehabilitation tax credit program will generate greater private investments on many levels. Since rehabilitation is a real estate activity, it generates property tax revenues year after year. Because rehabilitation is labor-intensive, income taxes paid by these construction workers are higher. Because materials for rehab tend to be purchased locally, sales tax revenues are higher. Just an example of some of the specific kinds of economic development spinoffs that can be expected. I don't know that it's been mentioned yet, but 29 other states already have a historic preservation tax credit, including most of the states around us, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, North Dakota, Missouri, and Kansas are among those states. Because Minnesota doesn't have a tax credit, I believe we're put at a competitive disadvantage. And rehab projects that could go to rehabilitate old schools or factories or old hotels in Minnesota are going to our neighboring states. So I think we need to add this tax credit so that we can at least be on a level playing field with our neighbors. I would also point out that the letter from Dick Moe is just one organization supporting this tax credit proposal. There's a list of 28 cities and statewide organizations and national organizations that are supporting this proposal. And I hope that we'll be able this fall at the National Preservation Conference in October, which will be held in St. Paul, to announce that Minnesota will be the 30th state with a state historic tax credit. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Any questions from the committee? Anybody else like to testify on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I would like to make a comment, though. Sure. I hope this is your lucky year.
Thank you.
Back every year.
Senator Johnson, it costs roughly about $6 million a year to do. Ongoing money.
But, Mr. Chair, we are sitting in a beautiful building.
This is, Little Falls actually is the third oldest city in the state. There's some awesome stuff downtown. You ought to come up sometime and visit it. Great parks.
Mr. Bobick, I think I'm going to be going through town Friday afternoon. I'm on my way up to Staples for Friday night. Many of us probably will be. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything else from the committee? Senator Moi? No?
Nope.
Chair lays over without objection. Senate File 385 for possible inclusion. Members, we've got one other bill. It's actually not in front of us. It's over in Judiciary. Senator Moi was going to hear it last week. That's how we ended up with the schedule, but then the snowstorm hit and it wasn't able to get done. So I thought, is the department still here to talk about Senate File 611? It's the department's disclosure bill. It's actually in the possession of the Judiciary Committee right now, but they're going to hear it and we'll be sending it over here. So we will let you know if there are Judiciary makes any changes to it. But I thought it might be helpful if we just kind of get it out of the way here today. Senate File 611 is in front of the committee. From the department, we have whom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rick Walzer. I'm a staff attorney with the Department of Revenue. And I'd like to do a quick summary of the department's disclosure data practices bill. Section 1 is a clarification that adds the motor vehicle sales tax chapter to the list of tax types that are covered by Chapter 270B, which is the Department of Revenue tax data chapter. Section 2 is a clarification. It strikes an existing clause that's already in the law and makes that clause a separate sentence to clarify that the informant data provision in Chapter 270B does not apply to property tax. Section 3 is an amendment that clarifies what the original intent of Chapter 16D was when it was enacted about 10 years ago, authorizing the Department of Revenue to collect non-tax debts referred by other state agencies. This clarifies that the Department of Revenue can use tax return information to the extent necessary to collect those non-tax debts. Section 4 has to do with the JobZ and Bioscience Zone program, which involves three different government entities, the local government unit where the business is located, the Department of Economic Development, and the Department of Revenue because of the special tax reductions that are involved. And Section 4 clarifies that the Department of Revenue can disclose tax information to these other entities to the extent necessary to administer these programs. And finally, Section 5 is a property tax provision. It has to do with Class 1B homestead applications for blind and disabled homeowners. Section 5 transfers this function to the counties. Currently, the Department of Revenue collects these applications, but since these applications are no longer based on income, Section 5 transfers the function to the counties, and the only reason this section is in our data practices bill is that there's a sentence in the section that says that any our Social Security numbers that are on these forms and any income or medical information that are on these forms are classified as private data on individuals. And that's pretty much everything that's in the bill.
Senator Skoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. On this page three, this part with the Social Security numbers you're just talking about, is this going to be a new requirement that the people provide their Social Security numbers with regard to this 1B homestead declaration?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, it's not a new requirement. The current form does require the applicant to furnish their Social Security number, but because of the way this section had to be drafted, a lot of what's in the current law had to be repeated in this new section.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Moy, you're taking up this bill soon?
Tomorrow, too. And, Mr. Chair, we'd like to have both bills, if possible, on the agenda tomorrow so that we could get it addressed and get it back.
And then once you've finished reviewing them, you can send them back to us?
Yes.
So, members, we will, if there are any changes, we will submit them to you. Otherwise, this is a department bill. We'll consider it for inclusion in the omnibus bill once we have it in our possession. Anything else, members? We're going to meet divisions meeting Monday, Senator Skoy?
Monday morning, 8:30.
Full committee will meet Tuesday. We're going to take more local bills next week. And if time provides, we're probably going to have the department come in and talk about limited market value study. And if the most recent tax incidence study is available, we probably will also have an overview of that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, when she was in front of the committee, talked about a report. Was that the market value report that Senator Rest was talking about? Do you remember?
That was the limited market
value. Limited market value. Okay, and that's what we're going to be hearing.
That report is out, the most recent limited market value report, and we will try to find time next week. Depending on how many bills get introduced or re-referred to us, I think we're likely to have some time next week to do an overview. That limited market value report, I've looked at it briefly, will be very helpful for members to take a look at. And the tax incidents we all enjoy to see. Do we know, Mr. Manson, is the tax incidents possibility that will be ready for us?
Next week?
Okay. See, Mr. Chair,
very good. Senator Skoy.
Mr. Manson, the property tax division had asked the department about some information with regard to agriculture valuation. Could you check and see how that's coming? Thank you to us. I'd appreciate it.
Anything else, members? Committee's adjourned.